This is about holy name of the Lord, written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It's actually in verse. It's poetry form in Bengali. But anyway, we'll discuss about that. Okay. So, as we know, chanting the Hare Krishna is Yuga Dharma. So in this work, which is a poetic work, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has a conversation between Lord Chaitanya and Haridas. And because Haridas Thakur is the Namacharya, he is the one that does all the speaking. If we look in Chaitanya Charitamrita also, we'll see that Lord Chaitanya asks Haridas Thakur to glorify the holy name, and then he gives a long discussion. So based on that, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has written this work. So, it's called Harinam Chintamani. Chintamani, the literal meaning of Chintamani is, of course, Chinta means thought, Mani means jewel, thought jewel. So Chintamani, as we know, it is a stone, and when you touch it and you think of something, you get it. A wish-fulfilling stone. So it's something like the desire tree. You go to the tree and you wish for something, and then pops off the tree, you get a fruit, which is your desire. So, in other words, Chintamani means something which fulfills all your desires. And the name is compared to Chintamani. So it can fulfill all of your desires, whatever desire you may have. So this verse occurs actually in Padma Purana, Nama Chintamani Krishna Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha Purna Sudo Nityamukto Vinatva Nama Namnaha. The name of the Lord fulfills all desires like Chintamani. It is the very form of Krishna. It is full of consciousness and rasa. It is complete, pure, eternally liberated. This is because it is non of the non-difference of the name from Krishna. So Krishna is also Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha, Purna, Sudha, Nityamukta, etc. So because name is non-different from him, name is exactly the same as Krishna. Of course, all of the different forms of the Lord are, in one sense, Purna, Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha, Sudha, Nityamukta. But then Krishna is in a special position because he is Swayam Bhagavan, so he is more perfect. You know, he's most perfect, Purnatama. Everyone is pure, of course, all the forms are pure, but Krishna is Purnatama. And as Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha, the form of Rasa, Lord Chaitanya displays all of the rasas in full, whereas the other forms don't. So there's some distinction of Chaitanya or Krishna from the other forms of the Lord. So the first section is about the place of the name within our sadhana. So to discuss the name, we have to discuss sambandha gyan, or philosophical knowledge concerning the Supreme Lord and other real things. So of course, sambandha means relationship, and jnana means knowledge. So it's knowledge of relationships. And in the scriptures, we'll often find that the purpose of the guru is to give sambandha jnana, knowledge of our relationship with the Lord. So the different philosophies will have different explanations. Some philosophies don't have anything real. There's nothing real. Everything is illusion. That's Buddhism. Other philosophies will accept one real thing, Brahman. Everything else is illusion. That's Mayavad philosophy. Only one real. Some philosophies, no real thing. Other philosophies, only one real thing. The Vaishnavas accept many real things, but principally we'll just categorize them into a few categories. So at the top we have Ishvara. This is the supreme independent conscious entity, supreme Lord. And next to him we have his Shakti, called the Chit Shakti or Antaranga Shakti. This is his Shakti, which manifests the spiritual world, the name, the form, the qualities, and the Leela of the Supreme Lord. All this is done by Shakti, spiritual Shakti. So it's non-different from the Lord. Then we have another Shakti called the Tatastha Shakti, or marginal energy. This is the Jiva, who is conscious also, but dependent, not independent. So he is something like the Chit Shakti because he is conscious, but he is a little particle, small, and as a particle, there are infinite number of them. And these little particles have some free will and a capacity for unlimited bliss. And they are called tatashta, or on the margin or on the border, because they can be situated in either the material world or the spiritual world. They have a choice, one or the other. Tatasta means border or shore, or like tata means a shore. For instance, Janavi Tata, in our song. So that's on the bank, on the shore of the Ganga. So a tata is a shore. So tatasta means situated on the shore. So the shore is the dividing line between the water and the land. So this tata is between the spiritual world and the material world. And the jiva is kind of situated in the borderline, like between land and water. And so you can choose one way or the other. So therefore it's called tatasta, situated on the border. You can go either way. Then we have the other energy. This is the bahiranga shakti, or external energy of the Lord, property. This is dependent, but it is unconscious. Unlike the jiva, it hasn't got any consciousness. There's no small particles of consciousness, or no free will, nothing. And we can analyze this into 23 or elements or any number. And then the elements come together and make planets or worlds, lokas. And we are living in one of those lokas. And then we have material bodies made out of these property also. About external energy. So we have something like this. Ishvara, Chitshakti, Achitshakti. From Chitshakti we get spiritual world and everything, name, form, qualities of the Lord. And from Achitshakti we get material world, which is what we know. And then we got, in between we have the Jivshakti that can go one way or the other. And if he's in the material world, he can go to the spiritual world. That's the option. Okay. Once you're there, you don't go back. So it's a one-way arrow this way. From the material world. So, this is the jiva in the material world, which was over here. The jiva in here we're talking about. So generally we talk from this position because we're all in the material world. Yeah? And we're all conditioned souls. So we speak from this point of view here. Yeah? So, in scripture we'll have methods of getting us out of the material world. So we have different processes. We have karma, jnana, astanga yoga, and bhakti yoga. These are the major processes for getting us out of the material world. And we end up in the spiritual world. So we can't know about these processes unless we go to scripture. We can't concoct this on our own. It won't work. But these processes also have limitation. For instance, karma. What's its limitation? You have to stay in the material world. You can go to Svarga Loka, you can go to Brahma Loka, but you can't get out simply by karma yoga. You can go upwards, but you can't get out. So there's limitation. You can get peace. You can get sattva guna. Then jnana. From jnana and from yoga, you can get liberation from the material world. You can get out of the material world. But it doesn't mean you can go to the spiritual world. You can just get out of the material world. So it's our bhakti that we get. Spiritual world. So there's limitations on these other processes of where you can, what you can do. Okay. So in terms of bhakti, we have these processes. Here's the processes here. We're going to the spiritual world. But if we just take the bhakti process, we can just do that and go to the spiritual world. Now originally, people were meant to do karma. After they finish karma, they get graduate and they go to jnana. And they graduate from that, then they go to Astanga Yoga. And they graduate from that, then they go to Bhakti Yoga. Like that. So it's a gradual process. Huh? So that's what the use of the processes are for. To complete one and go to the next process, then go to Bhakti, then go to spiritual world. But that's not considered to be applicable in Kali Yuga. So instead of that, we just do Bhakti. So we start with Bhakti, and we just do Bhakti, 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 and we end up in the spiritual world. So we just go through different stages of Bhakti, that's all. We don't have to switch from one method to the other and learn something new and then do that and then after that learns another thing and learn another thing. We just do one process all the way through. Okay. So, only qualification is faith. Then we do start the bhakti, starts the sadhana. Second stage is called bhava, third is prema, and with that you're qualified for the spiritual world. Okay. So, that is the method of going by that arrow. Okay, so within bhakti, then we have chanting of the name. Yeah? So, as we see bhakti, bhakti, bhakti goes all the way through. So the same with the name. So then we start with the name, and in bhav bhakti we do the name, in prem bhakti we do the name, and then in spiritual world we do the name. So it's an eternal process that goes on. It's a sadhana, and it's also the perfection. So it's not a temporary thing. It's not a means to an end. It is the means, but it's also the end. It's both things. Yeah. So this is considered to be the practical process for the people of Kali Yuga. So, what is special about the name? We have the Lord, as I mentioned before, the Lord has his chit shakti. And one of his chit shaktis, he's got various categories of chit shakti. One of them is sandini shakti. So through that sandini shakti, the Lord manifests his name, his activities, his qualities, and his form. All spiritual, non-material things. It's all chit shakti, so it's spiritual. Okay. It's actually through these things that we can know the Lord, not only from our point of view, but even in the spiritual world. How do we know the Lord? We can see his form with a spiritual eye. We can appreciate his qualities. We can observe his activities. So through these factors, we get to know about the Supreme Lord in the spiritual world. So, the speciality of the name is that all of these other aspects are condensed into the name itself. So we have these things here, yeah. But actually everything ends up in the name. So the form of the Lord, the qualities of the Lord, the activities of the Lord, everything about the Lord ends up within the name. So it's a very convenient sadhana, because through the name then you can realize everything. In spite of the fact that it looks like it's only sound. Yeah. So we start out by chanting the name of the Lord, very simply, but through that we'll get realization of the form, the qualities, and the activities, and then everything about the Lord. We establish our relationship with the Lord, and we realize the Lord, and we serve the Lord in the spiritual world. Yeah. So that name itself does everything. Yeah. Through that name, everything is revealed. Okay, so there are different types of names. We have primary names and secondary names, or mukya nama and gona nama. And they have to do with, let's say, primary aspects or qualities of the Lord and secondary aspects. So the primary names are the ones we want to use. So these describe the pastimes and the forms of the Lord in the spiritual world. And if we chant those names, then we get prema and we can go to the spiritual world. And the other names describe the Lord generally in relationship to the material world. And they'll give us material elevation and ultimately liberation. Well, this is not what we want. So we have to chant primary names, not secondary names. So, for example, let me put an example here. Yeah, okay. Examples. Primary name. Something to describe the Lord's form. Anybody know the name? Shamsundar, very good. That describes a form with blackish in quality, you know, color. And it's the name, you know, it's Krishna's name. Or activities. We've got Govinda, one who takes care of the cows. So these are just in the pastimes. We've just got the pastimes and the forms of the Lord, the qualities of the Lord in the spiritual world. So these are primary names. So these are the ones we should chant. Secondary names are things like creator of the material world, Jagat Shrashta, or Jagat Karana, cause of the material world, Shakshi, Jagat Shakshi, witness of the material world, Paramatma. These are all things to do with the material world, how the Lord functions in the material world. These are secondary aspects. And if we're in the spiritual world, we're not really concerned about that. We don't want to think about the material world anymore. So if you want to go to the spiritual world, you have to concentrate on the spiritual aspects of the Lord there. So the secondary names are all these types of things. Paramatma names, Brahman names, creator, destruction of the material world, all this is secondary names.
Quick question. What about Jagannath? That means the Lord of the universe.
Lord of the universe, yeah. So in one sense it is related to the material world, but then of course it also has spiritual spiritual connotation, because he also exists in the spiritual world. He's called Jagannath there. So it also refers to a form in the spiritual world. Whereas a form like Mahavishnu or Karnaksha Vishnu is not in the spiritual world. And they're particularly doing with material energy itself. So even though Jagannath is called Lord of the universe, he's also eternally in the spiritual world. So therefore he plays both roles. Yeah. So by the primary names, we end up with realization of Krishna's spiritual world. By secondary names, we can end up in Brahman. Okay. So there are different types of chanting, which is a big subject. So we have Nama Parat. It's not necessarily go through these stages. It's not that you go from Nama Parat to Nama Basa. You don't have to go to Nama Parat stage in the beginning. You can start with Nama Basa or even Sudanam. So, but anyway, these are three different things. So Nama Parat is one stage in which one conceives of Krishna and his name are different, and that name is material. And of course we can have all sorts of misconceptions, like, you know, God is just temporary and ultimately Brahman is the final realization, things like this. So that's all Nama Parad. Huh? And if you chant with that type of attitudes, nothing happens. Then we have Nama Bas. One can chant with or without faith. There's two types. Huh? And it's called a Bas because there are ignorance and impurities involved. So this is acceptable. By chanting in Nama Bas, you can slowly progress. And the third stage is the preferable stage. That's called Sudanam, or pure chanting of the name. This is with knowledge instead of ignorance, and with purity, not impurity. So then this is recommended. This is, by this we get quick progress. Now by Nama Bas, we can get slow progress, but we can't get prema. So we have to progress in Nama Bas too. Pure chanting. When we have pure chanting, then we can quickly progress to prema. Lord Chaitanya in the Chaitanya Charitamrita actually gives three definitions of chanting. This is in relation to the people of Kuling Gram, who are actually the people of Navadvip. So every year they would go to Puri to visit Lord Chaitanya and stay for some months for Rath Yatra festival, and for a few months later, then they would go back to Bengal for the rest of the year. Then they would come back again. So one year they asked Lord Chaitanya, who is a Vaishnava? So Lord Chaitanya said, anyone who chants the name once is a Vaishnava. So they were a little puzzled by that. They didn't ask him. So they accepted that answer and they went back to Navadvip and they thought about it for a whole year. What does that mean, chanting once the name of the Lord, he's a Vaishnava? So they went back next year and again they asked the question, who's a Vaishnava? And then Lord Chaitanya said, one who chants constantly, purely, is the Vaishnava. So they were a little satisfied with that. And they went back after 4 months and they were sitting in Navadvip that year and they thought about that answer also. The next year they went back again, they said, who is a Vaishnava? And then Lord Chaitanya said, one who, on meeting and seeing, inspires others to chant purely, he is the Vaishnava. So therefore Lord Chaitanya indicated different levels of chanting. So we have the acceptable level, once is okay, chanting constantly is better, and it's best if actually our chanting will inspire others to take up the name of the Lord. So this involves preaching. So that's considered the best stage in terms of chanting. So what is the qualification for chanting? The minimum standard is human being. So even one is very sinful, one is qualified for chanting. Something happens. In other words, by chanting, something should happen. So even if you're the most sinful person, if you utter the name once even, it has effect. So the example is Ajumil. Now he chanted, and simply when he chanted the name, he said that, not even meaning the Supreme Lord, no faith, he just said, my son is called Narayana. So when he uttered the name Narayana, all of his karmas were dissipated. So he got effect. Very powerful effect from chanting the name of the Lord once. And of course he didn't chant once, because once he named his son Narayan, he chanted for the rest of his life that name. So he got very great effect. Simply, he had no qualification, he was completely sinful, etc. But he chanted as a human being, so he got effect. So that's why any human being is qualified. If we look in the Bhagavatam, we will also see that it always glorifies the name, and even bhakti process, it says that anyone can take for this process. It doesn't matter if he's Sudra or he's Brahmana, or even if he's not in the Varnashram system, he can chant also. We can take for the process of bhakti and chant. So it's open to any human being. So either with faith or without faith, doesn't matter. It will have effect. Then, the other qualification, of course, is with faith. That is preferable. So with faith, then one is called a Vaishnava. And the other processes require different qualifications. For instance, deity worship will require cleanliness of place, cleanliness of your body, cleanliness of utensils, so many things like that. If you want to do sacrifices, then not only place and body have to be, and utensils have to be pure, the time also has to be proper. So you have to use astrology to find out the proper time. Certain tithis are bad, certain hours are bad, this and that. Certain combinations of stars are bad, constellations are bad. So you have to use time also and consider pure and impure time. So there are many, many qualifications for other processes, but these are not considered in chanting the name. So any place, any time, clean or unclean, it doesn't really matter. It has effect. So what is the rules then? In one sense, there's no rules. It's beyond rules, but some things are more favorable. And if we want to get prema, then we have to do certain things. So we have to take a primary name of the Lord, not a secondary name. We have to have we can do namabhas, but sudanam is preferable because you get quick progress, and that you get prema. If we do namabhas, we have to eventually come to sudanam. And we can chant once, as Ajamil did and got free of his karmas, but you can't get prema by that. So we have to chant purely and constantly. And of course, to help this process, we have association with devotees, proper devotees, and we do favorable actions and avoid unfavorable actions. So this actually is the process in summary for attaining our goal, which is prema. So this is basically what we're trying to do. We're trying to get from the material world to the spiritual world. To do that, we have to come to the stage of bhakti, prema. We can't go if we got bhava or sadhana bhakti or no bhakti. So we have to do the bhakti, then in that bhakti we have to get to prema, and the process is bhakti, but in the bhakti process is name. Okay, so that's part one. Any questions there so far? So, where are we here? Harinam. Okay, number two. So now we go on to namabhas. Okay. So, as I said, this is the second type. The first one's aparad. We'll deal with that later. So now we deal with the second type called namabhas. So there are many types of chanting, so we have to actually understand the difference in the method of chanting. So what is an abhas? So an abhas literally means it's a dull image caused by obstructing things, like the clouds in the sky will obstruct the sun. So we can see the sun through the clouds, but not clearly. So there we say this is an abhas of the sun. Yeah? It's not the clear image. It's interrupted by clouds. So it's a dull image. And, of course, we also know that the sun actually is not really covered by anything. If we go in an airplane and fly above the clouds, then it will be bright sun. So from our point of view, of course, then it is covered. But the sun actually is not covered. So the same applies to the name. If the name is obstructed by impurities and ignorance, then we call that abhas. But the name itself is not affected. It is pure. Nothing. It's not affected at all. But for us, we get a weak effect because of that obstruction. So when the sun is shining through the clouds, we get effect. We get light. But it's not as hot as if there's no clouds. And therefore the plants don't grow as good. So in the same way, if we do namabhas, since it's a pure name, we get some effect. But it's not the strongest effect. So it's like clouds in the sky for the plant. So just as the brilliance of the sun extinguishes darkness, the holy name extinguishes the darkness of illusion. So the name is compared to the sun. So the sun creates light, and from light we can see everything. So in the same way, the holy name, by chanting, will destroy maya. But at the same time, if there are clouds in the sky, we get some illumination, but it's not perfect. So, what are those anarthas? We have ignorance and material tendencies. Ajnana and anarthas. So when these are prominent, then we'll end up with the stage of namabhas. And we don't get full effect. But we can't say that the name itself is really affected. It's only because of our particular coverings that this is happening. So it's not that the name is affected at all. It's beyond all of this. So we cannot say that the name is weak. It's just our perception of the name has caused all of this due to our covering. So, because of that, we may chant, but we don't get the full effect. So we'll think, well, how come I'm not getting any effect? I'm chanting and chanting and chanting and then nothing is happening. So, it can be because of that abhas. You're getting very little effect coming through. So if you don't give the plant sunlight, or very little light, then it won't grow. And if you give it lots of light, it will grow very nicely. So if we do namabhas all the time, we get very slow effect from the chanting. So, therefore, it's advisable we clear up that namabhas. So what are the obstructions? One is ignorance, the other is anarthas. So ignorance is compared to fog, and anarthas is compared to clouds in the sky. So ignorance of what? So ignorance of the name. And not only the name, but of bhakti in general. The process. So we may think that the name is material. It's only a material sound. And we think the process of bhakti is a material process by which you only get material results. So that is a type of ignorance. We have to understand the name is not different from Krishna. Krishna is a spiritual entity. So therefore it's beyond the material world. We have ignorance of position of Krishna. When we're chanting the name, then we may think, oh, Krishna's only a devata. Krishna's got a material body. Krishna can only give material benefits. Krishna and Durga and Shiva and Ganesh and Kartikeya and whatnot are all the same. So that's also a type of ignorance. So you can get some effect by that, but at the same time, it's very limited and you get material effects only. And position of the jiva. Now we have to, as I explained, our philosophy is jiva is separate from Supreme Lord, dependent but conscious and in the material world but can go to the spiritual world. That's our model. If we have a different model, then we don't get the same results. So we think that jiva becomes God. Jiva merges into God and becomes God. Then we won't get the effect of chanting the name. We won't get prema. You may get Brahman, but you won't get prema. So we have to know the true identity of the jiva. And we have to know what the goal is. Even in the material world, if you don't know what the goal is for anything, you don't achieve it. So in business, if you don't have a goal, your business fails. So you have to identify what your goal is, a 1-year goal, a 10-year goal, or whatever, in your business. And then you can attain it. And if you don't have that goal, it's very unlikely you're going to get anything out of it. It's only maybe Krishna's mercy you'll get something. Otherwise, you won't attain your goals. You need a goal. So we have to figure out what the goal of our sadhana is. So we, on our own, we can't do that. So therefore, we have to go to Scripture. And Scripture will tell us. This is our position in the material world, sambandhagyan. We can't speculate. Then it will give a process to get out of the material world. And what is the result when we get out of the material world? What happens? That is the goal. So we do this practice and we have a certain goal in mind. So what is the goal? Goal is prema. We may think the goal is liberation. We may think the goal is going to Svargaloka. So we can get that out of the holy name, but then we're limited. We don't go any further than that. So we have to know what the proper goal is, not some other goal. So that's the ignorance. Anarthas. So we have different types of anarthas, which are like the clouds. As I said, anarthas are basically material tendencies. So we can divide it up into desires, incompatible desires. And we have four types. Now we want to enjoy. I want to enjoy now. And this present body. So that type of desire to get a position and get some money and spend your money on something and work and whatever and enjoy. That type of aspiration and right now in this body. And then we have a little more elevated aspiration, and that is to enjoy next lifetime by doing punya, which probably is not very current in the modern world, but it was in, if you look in the scriptures, you'll find it's quite evident there that there's so many promises, and at least next lifetime you can enjoy nicely in Swargaloka if you do punyas now. So that's also an aspiration to enjoy in the next lifetime, materially. Yeah? So that's also to be rejected. And then, of course, if we do yoga and we try to get siddhis, yeah, and different powers, yeah, mystic powers, that also is anartha. And then the final one is liberation, which looks like it's not a material desire, because to get liberation you have to give up all material desires. But even this is considered anartha for those aspiring for prema. If we just want liberation, fine, we can get that through the name, and you get your goal achieved. But if we want prema, this becomes anartha. Because in liberation, we reject the form, qualities, and activities of the Lord. And doing so, we cannot get prema at all. So therefore, it becomes an anartha. Liberation or desire for liberation becomes an anartha for devotees. So that's one category of anartha. So if we chant with these aspirations, then that is considered to be like clouds. It will weaken the effect of the name. Now, of course, based upon our general tendency to enjoy in the material world, then other things may happen. Then we can develop more intense problems, such as greed, intense greed, or obsessions with certain types of enjoyment, or addictions, or whatever. And the opposite of that, of course, is once our desires are frustrated, we end up with anger and envy, things like that, negative emotions. And as a result of that, we may end up cheating and doing things like that. And desiring fame, pratishtha, so many different types of transformations of desire can take place in the material world. So all this is called weakness of heart, arising from desire. The third category here is aparad. As I mentioned before, we have nama aparad in a separate category. If the anartha, if it's an aparad and it's an anartha, it means it's not intentional and not constant. And when it becomes intentional and constant, then we cannot even say it's an anartha anymore. It doesn't just cause a cloud, it may destroy bhakti also. So that is the dangerous aspect of aparad. If it is unintentional and not constant, then it becomes simply a obstacle. And bhakti can still have some effect. So, aparad against the name or against bhakti, those are the nam-aparads, which we'll discuss later. The process, in other words, offense against the process. We got offense against the deity. If we think the deity is material, or any of the seva aparads. This is called, this is another type of aparad. We have aparad against not only the deity, but the devotees of the Lord. It's called Vaishnava aparad. So this is a very serious aparad, also included within nama aparad. And then we have jiva aparad. This is violence against jivas in general in the material world. That means violence. So that is also considered to be some sort of aparad because it's unfavorable for bhakti. So these are the anarthas. So these have to be, this plus this has to be removed if you want to get to the pure stage.
When we're talking about the anarthas, the ignorance, how do we find out whether it's the theoretical understanding or the really meaning? Like if you're thinking like the name is not material, okay, fine, by reading the scriptures we know the name is not material.
Yeah.
So whether it's like still that we are still on the theoretical platform or
okay. Yeah. Well, at least if we're on the theoretical platform, that's one level of knowledge. Yeah. At least we do not and with a faith, we'll accept it. Now, of course, because we're still in the material world, it's not an absolute acceptance, because if it were, we'd be in the spiritual world, it's just in the material world. So it's in one sense relative still, because we've still got a material mind or whatever. But at least we accept this idea. So therefore, that removes that anartha as such, or that ignorance. So even if it is theoretical, it's better than having the opposite idea that we think God is material, name is material, all that. And so it helps us progress because of that clarity. So what happens with nam aparad when it's intentional? As I said, this is the bad part. We actually can destroy bhakti. We get no progress at all. And if the aparad is unintentional and not constant, then it's part of anartha in nama bhas, and we can get some slow progress out of that. Okay, so the progress is like this. We have nama bhas, and we may start out chanting somehow or other, and we don't have knowledge, so that's nama bhas. Then, through devotees, we get sambandha gyan, which I previously mentioned. We understand position of God, jiva, material world, process of bhakti, and all that. Okay, then we get process, avijaya. So we get sambandha and avijaya, which is name. And through that, we get prayojana, or prema. So Lord Chaitanya has said, actually, scripture deals with three things only. Sambandha, avijaya, and prayojana. So if we know these, and we practice bhakti, then we get to the sudanam stage, pure chanting stage. So we have nama bhas, but we get sambandha again, avijaya, then we get the sudanam, then we can get spiritual world. So, if we're at the stage of nama bhas, then it has effect. One is, it's a punya. So if you really want material results, you can get material results from chanting. In other words, we have anartas, and we have desires for going to Svargaloka or enjoying in this life or whatever. You can get those desires fulfilled by chanting. It's not pure, but you can get these results. And even if you don't have these intentions of getting these things, still you can get them. The Lord may offer them to you anyway, even if you're pure. As in the case of Dhruva, when Dhruva became pure, and he saw the Lord, and the Lord touched him, and he was purified. And then the Lord said, I'm going to give you all the material opulence you want. And you can have your own planet in the spiritual world. So the chanting and can give that. It can give anything in the material world. The devotee may or may not accept it. If it's favorable, he may accept, it's unfavorable, reject. The name can give liberation. Nama bhas can give liberation. It's not what the devotee wants, so therefore the devotee rejects that, but it can give liberation. And then the good effect of the chanting nama bhas is eventually, by doing it enough and getting association, then you come to the pure stage. You get faith and you chant with knowledge. So nama bhas, if it's accidental, by much exposure, it can help us develop faith. When we get faith, then we can chant intentionally in nama bhas, and then by association we come to sudanam. So these are some of the effects of nama bhas. So there are two types of nama bhas. One is no faith. Now that is like accidental, as in the case of ajamil. But that should be without offense. At the same time, then we can get very strong effects, like destruction of all karmas in the case of ajamil. Then is with faith. So with faith means we have ignorance and anartas, but we also have faith in the name. So it's intentional chanting, not accidental. So without faith, this chanting has been described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And there are several varieties of this. One is called Sanketya. When the name refers to something else, as in the case of Ajamil, Narayan meant his son, not the Supreme Lord. But it had effect. So this was chanting without faith. It was some coincidence that he named his son Narayana. Another is Parihas. In joking, one may say the name of the Lord. It's a joke. But without criticism. So this also has effect. Another is stoba. It probably doesn't take place in English, but in Sanskrit they may just use the syllables of the name Krishna or Vishnu to fill up space in their chanting verses or something, and they need the meter to get the correct meter. They may fill up the space by putting in a name there, even though they have no faith in the Supreme Lord. They just put that name in there to make the meter proper or whatever. That's called stoba. And the last is hela, inattention. One may just say the name of the Lord inattentively while sighing or yawning or whatever. Krishna, oh Krishna. Like that. So that's another type of nama bhas. So these are all without faith. People may just chant somehow or other by these different methods. And there's even another one mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. A person who chants the name of the Lord while falling off a cliff or stumbling on the road or getting injured or attacked or bitten by a snake or tormented with fever or attacked with sticks. You may just say the name of the Lord, O Lord, or O Krishna, or Vishnu, or whatever. So that also is Namabhas. There's no faith there, but somehow or other he happened to utter the name out of fear or whatever, or pain or whatever. So this has effect, actually, as in the case we see of Ajamil. So then we have chanting with faith. So there are two varieties. Actually, one is not real faith at all, but this is classified as with faith. So one is called chaya. That's the one we've been talking about. We have a weak faith, a little faith, and we have ignorance and anarthas. And then that will lead to sudhanam by getting instructions from devotees and guru, etc. Sambandhagyan, etc. That's the one we've been talking about. The other is called pratibimba. It's not real faith. It's intentional, but with false faith, because actually we don't believe in the form and qualities and activities of the Lord. We think they're all material. And we may do it only for material benefits or whatever, or liberation or something like that. So this is called pratibimbanam abhas, because the apparata is so strong, the effect of the name is very, very limited. It's like the form of the sun and the water is no longer there in the rough water. It's all fractured. And so we don't even get the same effect as Namabhas, where we have this type of some good effect coming through. So this one does not yield the same effect as that one. So this is the Namabhas chanted by impersonalists, etc. They may also do kirtan and whatever, but you get this effect. Okay. So, what is the remedy for Namabhas? So, we have to get knowledge, so we take shelter of guru and devotees. So, the devotees will teach Sambandhagyan. Real position of Supreme Lord, position of Jiva, matter. And then he'll instruct us on the proper method of getting out of the material world. So, that, of course, is chanting and bhakti process called Abhijaya. And through that, then we get to sudhanam, and sudhanam we get prema. So that's the process. Okay. Fine. Any question there? And that part two finished. Oh, we can do this real quick. So that covers the question.
Jiva prarthi offers to the jiva can destroy bhakti.
If he comes to the stage of committing offense in the strength of chanting the holy name, then it becomes an aparad there. But if before bhakti we murder somebody or kill an animal or whatever like that, that does not obstruct. Because even the most sinful person as such can take the chanting. But after we start chanting and then we use that to commit more sin, then that can be aparad, turns into aparad. Several effects of the Namabhasa. Said you get material effects, then you can get liberation, and you can even go to Vaikuntha and get Sarupya and Saloki, those types of liberation. But you don't get the same effect as if you chant purely. So you go to the spiritual world, but your relationship with the Lord is very weak. So you don't develop rasa. The spiritual world, but you're very distant from the Lord, and you may meditate on Him. That's it. So it's like shanta rasa or something like that. So that's also explained, if we take that in terms of mixed bhakti and pure bhakti. So by Gyan Mr. Bhakti and Karma Mr. Bhakti, you actually can get better than mukti, because just by jnana you can get mukti. But by mixed bhakti, which is bhakti with a little bit of mixture of jnana or karma, you should get more than liberation. So therefore you can go to the spiritual world, but you get less than one who practices pure bhakti. So that's defined in terms of relationship with the Lord. So about karma, Mr. Bhakti, again, Mr. Bhakti, you end up with a very weak relationship with the Lord in the spiritual world. You don't see the Lord, or if you see him, it's the Shantarasa relationship, and you're like a sage in the spiritual world. Your relationship with the Lord is very, very distant. You think in terms of peace rather than anything else. And if you do Sudanam, then you establish a relationship in Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, or Madhurya. It's not really described, but it appears from what our acharyas say that your sadhana in the material world fixes your sarupa in the spiritual world. So you have to be careful now, not later. For instance, if we worship Vishnu, 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 then we end up as Vaikuntha with Vishnu. We can't decide once we're in Vishnu Loka that I'm going to change. We have to decide that now. To go to the spiritual world, you'll need prema. Now, it says in Bhagavad Gita, of course, whatever you think of when you die, you attain that. So you can think of Krishna, but if you think of Krishna as a material entity when you die, then you're not going to go to the spiritual world. You'll attain some Krishna in the material world. Maybe some form of, expansion of material expansion or something of Krishna in the material world, or Svarga Loka or something. So you actually need prema to go to the spiritual world. So if we chant as devotees and we remember the Lord when we die, even then if we don't have prema, we don't go directly to the spiritual world, but at least we're on the way going there. So next lifetime we become a devotee and then we can continue the process until we get prema. And then we go. That's the general process. Then there are mercy cases where the Lord just purifies you anyway and you go directly. So even if you don't achieve through sadhana the perfection, still the Lord may do that. Or even if you're a demon, the Lord may do that. In the case of Putana, Krishna killed her and she went to the spiritual world. That's mercy. That's exceptional. So the usual case is we should do the sadhana and perfect the sadhana, come to prema, then with that prema then we go to the spiritual world.
You know that we need prema to be in the spiritual world. And if you take the example of Ajamjaya and Sasna, when you narrated that if you are thinking of Krishna as a material entity, then what makes Ajamjaya case so different then?
Ajamjaya didn't think one way or the other. He just named his son Narayana, so there was no offense. And the result was not prema, it was only he destroyed his karmas.
So is it that last minute conversation between the Devdutas and Devdutas that...
Then he became a devotee after that. Then he practiced bhakti. Then he went to the spiritual world. But just chanting the name Narayana accidentally, that removed his karmas. That much it did. It did not give him bhakti or anything like that, but it helped make it favorable for bhakti. And then he heard the Vishnudutas and Yamadutas. Then he became devotional. And then he began practicing bhakti and achieved perfection. But we have problem, huh? So that means we have to, in other words, we go through stages in bhakti. We start with faith, then we do sadhana, and we start developing, and we go through anartha vritti, we get to nishta, ruchi, and asakti, then bhava and prema. So most people go through the gradual stage. They don't just immediately get prema. And that gradual stage may take some lifetimes. We see even in the case of exalted devotees like Bharat, he was on the stage of bhava. And of course he was king of the world too. So he was highly qualified. But even after bhava, it took him three lifetimes to get the prema. He became a deer, then he became Jad Bharat. Then as Jad Bharat, he got perfection, prema. So even after bhava, it took him three lifetimes. So before Bhava, it may take us more lifetimes also. Just to get to Bhava may take us maybe 10 lifetimes or whatever, we don't know. But if we practice sincerely, we get the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, we have the name, shelter of the name, that's also very powerful. So Bharat didn't do that, he was meditating on the Supreme Lord. So a different process. Now we have the name and we have mercy of Lord Chaitanya, so it becomes a little easier because of that. Still, it may take some lifetimes. But gradually, we develop the attraction to Krishna and material tendencies will be dissipated. That's also discussed here later. Okay. So, we have the first offense. This is quite an important one, called sadhu ninda, or criticizing the devotees. But not only criticizing, thinking badly of them, or doing bad things against devotees also is included. So in Chaitanya Charitamrita, this is called the mad elephant offense, because it's very, very destructive of bhakti. So first, it's called sadhu ninda, or criticism of sadhu or devotee. So who is the sadhu? We have to understand who is the proper sadhu. Of course, sadhu has a very general connotation in India. It can mean anybody. So we have to figure out who is a real sadhu. So as when we talk about sadhu and sadhu ninda and in devotional language, it actually means the devotee of the Lord. And we can define him in terms of many qualities. But the main quality is his surrender to the Lord. That's the most important quality. If that's not there, the other qualities are rather useless. So of course, if one is surrendered to Krishna, then he will manifest different qualities like tolerance, detachment, peacefulness, mercy, etc. But the main quality we should look for is that surrender to the Supreme Lord. That's the main thing, main quality. So that's how we'll define the sadhu. And these things are not important in defining who's a devotee and who's not a devotee. So varna is not important. So it doesn't make much sense in most countries, but it does in India. So some may think that a Brahmin can be the devotee but not the Sudra. So this is a misconception. And there's many examples, not only in Lord Chaitanya's Lila, because Haridas Thakur made Namacharya and he was not in the Varnashram system at all. He was a Muslim. He was worse than Varnashram. Then Lord Chaitanya made him Namacharya. And we'll see in the Sri Sampradaya also, some of the Alvars were dacoits. They began as dacoits and they became Alvars. So we can't base it upon caste, the Brahman, Vaishya, Kshatriya, Sudra or not. We can't use that as and say this is a devotee based on that. Ashram also we cannot use. So we cannot exclude a person who's a grihasta or whatever, or say that the sannyasi is superior to the grihasta or whatever. We can't make comparisons like that, or the brahmachari is less than the sannyasi. We can't judge a person based on ashram. These are external designations. Age we cannot also. So generally the concept is the older they are, the better maybe is devotees. Age doesn't always count either. So Sukadeva was very young when he recited Srimad Bhagavatam, but all the sages respected him because they knew he had knowledge, and therefore Parikshit listened to him and didn't listen to the other people, even though he was much younger than everybody else. Everybody respected him because of his wisdom. So age is not a consideration also. And strength is not a consideration. If a person is weak or whatever, or strong or whatever, we can't judge a person based on that as well. Or beauty. For instance, Vyasadeva looked very ugly, but he had all knowledge and wealth. Just because of poverty, we cannot exclude a person and say he's less of a devotee and the more prosperous devotee is better, or whatever. Wealth cannot be used as a standard. And followers, if the person has more followers, we cannot say he's a better devotee, and he has less followers, he's less of a devotee or whatever. We can't judge based on any of these. These are all material things, so we can't use those aspects. Okay. So we can't criticize based on these material things. We have to see the real quality of sadhu. Then there may be a problem with sin. We can criticize a person for sin. Brahman or not Brahman or whatever. We still, just because of sinful activities, we can criticize. So the general Stages of bhakti are like this. That we go from faith, sada, sangha, bhajana, kriya, narsana, mriti, nishta, ruchi, sakti, bhava, prema. These are the stages from beginning to end. And these have certain effects. So the purple aspect is how much the bhakti is increasing. And as the bhakti increases, we see that the anarthas become less. Okay? Until ultimately we end up with no anarthas down there in the bhava stage. Huh? No more anarthas left. We do see one thing is aparada. Effective aparada continues even in bhava. It goes down a little further, up until prema. And when we get prema, it's all bhakti and nothing else. Okay? So the effect of bhakti is to increase the bhakti and to destroy all the anarthas. By this we mean anarthas, meaning karmas, desires, ahankara. These things are all destroyed by the process of bhakti. But we see it's a gradual process. So, if we see fault, it's only natural. Unless you're in prema. We will see fault even in the bhava bhakta. So, one who is practicing bhakti necessarily is going to have some fault. Because he's not 100% pure. So we cannot just point out the faults of people and criticize them for that. Faults may be there, but we can't just criticize them based on the faults. We'll have to see faults in relation to his bhakti. If it's an obstacle or not, or if it's, it's becoming constant or whatever, then we can say that bhakti is not progressing if the faults become too many. Whatever. But simply because of fault, we cannot exclude a person and say he's not a devotee anymore. So, based on faults, we should not just say, oh, because he has that fault, therefore he's not a devotee. We should not criticize for that. So, he may not be a perfect devotee, may not be a pure devotee, but nevertheless, we cannot exclude him or reject him because of fault. So, surrender to Krishna, of course, means he appreciates other devotees. So the more one progresses in bhakti, he should appreciate devotees, and therefore he will avoid that type of criticism. He'll understand that, yes, everybody has faults. Okay? So even if he's advanced, he may have faults. But nevertheless, we appreciate that he is surrendering to Krishna.
All these stages of bhakti, like you talk about nishtha, then is it
half-half.
So is it the assumption here that the person has attained the nishtha stage or is beginning to attain the nishtha stage? How do you...
the top of the letter can be the beginning. The next one can be the end. I don't know. The beginning of nishtha.
So does it mean that a person who has attained nishtha has crossed the stage of anartha nivritti, or because
again, well, anartha nivritti is no, and in one sense, anartha nivritti will go on until bhava, and end of bhava actually, because they still have anartha in bhava stage, because of previous offenses. So it is said that actually, why did Bharat give up the worship of the Lord? And we know it because he became attracted to a deer. How could he become attracted to a deer when he saw the Lord directly? How could he become attracted after seeing the Lord to a deer? So the only answer is that the effect of previous aparad, maybe unintentional aparad or accidental aparad, somehow disturbed his heart. So in a bhava stage, there is a little bit of obstacle even there. That's why it's not prema. Even though you can have a vision of the Lord, it is not perfect, because that slight disturbance may be caused by influence of aparad from previous stages. So aparad are very dangerous because it can influence even in bhava stage and cause problems.
So the only difference between bhava and prema is aparad.
Not that he does commit aparads, but the influence of previous aparads can disturb his bhakti.
But as per your chart, unless you see aparad, you should just
Yeah, there it means influence of previous aparads. They can, in other words, the effect of aparads is so serious that it continues even in bhava to disturb you.
And same understanding is true for the others also? Ruchi, Asukhi, Asukhi, or actually committing?
Well, we can. Of course, we avoid as practicing seriously. We try to avoid, but there might be unintentional aparadhas at that stage. And those also will affect, disturb the bhakti a little bit, but not as much as intentional aparadhas, which will actually stop the bhakti or help destroy the bhakti, put it to a lower stage.
Is it correct to say the aparadhas are subset of anarthas?
In one sense, but I was saying that through namabhas, which has anarthas, you can progress slowly. Yeah? But if you have intentional aparadhas, you can destroy bhakti, so you don't progress at all. You go opposite. So that's why it is a subset. If it's unintentional and not constant, when it becomes intentional, then it tends to start destroying bhakti and you don't progress at all. So therefore, I put it in a separate category. Only for that reason. When it becomes intentional, then it destroys bhakti. Okay. So, we're talking about sadhu-ninda. So, the positive aspect is that the devotees are the cause of faith. How does faith arise? Accidental bhakti. Agata sukriti over many lifetimes. But what causes the agata sukriti? That means somebody has to chant the name that we hear over many lifetimes without faith. Or somebody has to make the prasadam that we eat accidentally over many lifetimes or whatever. So there has to be some devotee involved somewhere along the line in our agata sukriti, which causes faith. So therefore, and then after we get the faith, then we go to devotees and ask about bhakti and scripture, etc. So devotees are very important in the development of bhakti. So to start criticizing them also becomes a problem because we're destroying the very root or cause of bhakti. So, in Nectar, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya says that taking the foot water or the food or the dust of the devotee are the three activities which help you advance in bhakti. So, those are there. So, actually, Krishna usually does not act directly in this material world. When he comes as avatar, he may do so. When he's not avatar, then he will act through the devotees of the Lord and give mercy to them. So we can't directly get mercy from Krishna. Don't expect that. It may happen in some rare case, but generally the mercy will come through the devotees of the Lord. That's how we get our mercy in the material world. So that's why the devotee is very important. If we neglect the devotee, then how can we relate to Krishna at all? We can't. So we need that relationship. So we start rejecting devotees or criticizing devotees, then we cut off our relationship with the Lord. So that's very, very negative. So what are the types of criticism? As I said, we can criticize for all the wrong reasons. They had the X with all those things. Low birth, he's got the wrong birth, or he's got the wrong age, or he's got the wrong health, or he's got the wrong whatever. All these are material considerations. So those things are not considered proper. Or, in this life, previously to being a devotee, you may have done some simple activity. That we cannot criticize him for. That was before the bhakti started. So bhakti destroys all anarthas. So we should not criticize him for previous simple activity. And he may have traces of previous simple activity because the anarthas are still there. There's a gradual process of destroying an artist, but still they're going to influence a little bit. So even Nishtha's half-half. We still got half an artist and half bhakti. So it's going to manifest some faults at that stage also. So we generally don't criticize them because we know that with the continuous of bhakti, it'll all disappear. And then he may actually have sinful habits, traces. Then he may actually commit the sinful activity as a result of those habits. Even then, we should not unnecessarily criticize. Why? Because Krishna says, he's my devotee. If Krishna says he's a devotee, what right have we to say he's not the devotee? We cannot criticize also. So, when we start criticizing the devotee, then we more or less really cut off our... It's like building a big wall between us and the devotees and Krishna. How are we going to get mercy? We can't. Very, very difficult. So that's why it's such a serious offense. So, there we have this verse from Bhagavad Gita. Even one who commits the most abominable action if he's engaged in devotional service, he's considered saintly because he is properly situated in his determination. So this, of course, means that he actually is a sincere devotee, but he commits some sinful activity. So he still has faith in the Supreme Lord. And even after he commits the sinful activity, he still has faith in the Lord. So he continues his bhakti. So such a person, the Lord says, he is my devotee. This is actually from the commentary of Vishwanath on that verse. My attachment to my devotee is my very nature. That attachment does not decrease even if the devotee commits wrong, for I make him come to the highest standard. So in other words, Krishna understands that we're in the material world and bound to make mistakes. So on the other hand, because we've accepted the Lord, that becomes the positive point. And he understands that all this is all secondary, so he doesn't consider all the wrong. If someone with bad conduct, violence, thievery, adultery, worships me and worships no one except me and does not follow any of the process like karma or jnana and has no other desire than my desire, he is my devotee. Sadhu eva samantavya. But to do that, then he has to actually give up all these other processes and stick to Krishna, worshipping Krishna. So even he has sudarachara, it says here violence, thievery, adultery, whatever sinful activities are there. Then, at the same time, he has ananya bhak. His desire is only for the Supreme Lord. Then the Lord says, he's my devotee.
Is that possible to coexist? A desire only for Krishna, but still having
violence. Well, because as I said, we have this, anarthas gradually disappearing and bhakti increasing. So we do have anarthas still there, so that can give rise to desire. But his intention, of course, is I want to surrender to Krishna. It's not complete because he has that, portion of anarthas still there, which may give rise to sinful activity. But at least his intention is still, based on his faith, is to surrender to Krishna. So how can he be considered a devotee if he has a bad conduct? Bad conduct means greater material desires. Yeah? So how can he be considered a devotee? He needs to be respected as a devotee because of his devotee qualities. It is a command. Not doing so is an offense. My order is the authority. So you should also, mantavya, you should. It should be. You should do respect also. Because I respect. You should also respect. As a devotee. Which means Krishna takes more into consideration his devotional qualities than his faults. So therefore we should also. So he's considered a devotee in that portion where he worships you, and as a non-devotee in that portion where he commits adultery. Like he's got a good, bad, and a bad part. That could be our conclusion. But then Krishna says, no, he should be considered as a devotee in all his parts. He uses the word eva for emphasis. No, he's only a devotee. He's not anything but a devotee. He's not partial devotee or whatever. He is a devotee. We should not see his bad qualities at all. He is completely convinced. Samyakvavasitaha. He makes a splendid resolution. I will go to hell for my sinful actions, which are hard to give up, but I will not give up my dedicated worship of Krishna. So because of that determination to keep worshiping Krishna in spite of everything, the Lord accepts him as a devotee. So that is the sentiment of the Supreme Lord there. And that's why he makes this promise. I consider him my devotee, and you should also. So what is the cause of sadhu-ninda? The main cause is asat-sangha. Wrong association. So we know that good association is the cause of bhakti, and we develop bhakti through association. And on the other hand, asatsanga is the opposite. It destroys bhakti. It makes aparad, causes sadhu-ninda, etc. So what is asat? Asatsanga, of course, means association with people who are asat. So what is the definition of asat people? So there's different types of asat people. Now, one is a person who associates with women outside of marriage. That's asat sangha. If you associate with your wife in marriage, it's not considered asat. If you go outside of marriage, that's asat sangha. So you cannot associate with those people. But even within marriage, if the husband is under the control of the wife, that is considered asasanga.
Ooh.
Of course, we have an exception. If the wife is a devotee and the husband isn't, then we could say that it's an exception. And then asatsanga is also associated with persons who associate with women in this way. In other words, not just with a woman, but with a person who associates with women outside marriage, or associates with that person's asatsanga. And asat also refers to association with mayavadis, pretenders, atheists, and devata worshippers. All this is asatsanga. So if we associate with those, then it becomes a problem. Of course, the word association also is subject to some clarification there, because obviously in the material world we have to associate with many different types of people. We don't even know their background, what they're doing or whatever. So working and whatever, we have to do that. So sangha in its powerful aspect, or how it influences, is a friendly relationship where we act as equals. Then it becomes very influential. So as we know, aspects of good association is to give and to receive gifts, to feed and to take the food of other devotees, and to give knowledge and exchange knowledge, get knowledge. So if this works in the material world, we exchange things, we exchange ideas, we exchange food, we do all this in a very friendly way with materialists, then we're prone to get influenced by their ideas more. So when we have an equal, friendly relationship with another person, this is a cause of, more dangerous cause of asatsanga than simply seeing a person. So, in Nectar Devotion we have this interesting quotation. A man will attain the qualities of the person with whom he associates with, just like a crystal takes up the color of the object next to it. So if we have a white crystal, spatika, and we put it next to a red rose, it becomes reddish. And we take the spatika and put it next to a blue flower, it becomes bluish. Or we put it next to a yellow flower, it becomes yellowish. So people are like that. Very, very easily they absorb the qualities of people they're with. So we have to be very careful. This works positively and negatively. If we have us, satsanga, very good. Very easily we accept those qualities and we become purified. And we associate with asat people, then very quickly we can also assume their qualities. So it works both ways. It can be a good influence or bad influence, that sangha. So we have to avoid the asat sangha. Okay, so we have the devotees. They are sadhu, and we shouldn't criticize. But we have different levels of devotees also. So one is the Kanishta. This is the lowest level of a devotee or chanter. No sambandhagyan, therefore he has namabhas. Doesn't recognize the devotees, so he doesn't serve the devotees, and he may associate more with non-devotees. This is Kanishta. It's not a very healthy stage. Because of the wrong association there and the namabhas. So he has a little faith in the Lord. That's his good quality. But it's a risky stage. So the Madhyama is better. He has sambandhagyan, service to the superior Vaishnavas, association with equal Vaishnavas, gives mercy to the Kanishtas, avoids asat people, chants sudanam, avoids namaparad and sadhananda, and distinguishes Vaishnava from non-Vaishnava. So this is the healthy stage. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, actually all devotees must come to this stage. You cannot stay at the Kanishta stage. It's very unhealthy. So you have to come to this stage. Which is not difficult, because we avoid the namaparads, we associate with devotees, we get sambandhagyan, chant purely, and avoid non-devotees. So it's not a difficult thing to do. So this is the Madhyamanikari. So this is serious devotees will all be at this stage. They will all be at this stage. So this is considered the healthy stage of devotional service. So what is that association here? We can analyze the different types of association. Friendly with devotees on the same level. Yeah? We consider them same level and we act in a friendly way. Yeah? With superior Vaishnavas, service. And with Kanishthas, we give mercy to them by giving knowledge, giving instructions. And of course we avoid non-devotees. So this type of association is very, very important for the Madhyamadikari to advance. In fact, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says this is the main cause of advancement. If we know the different types of devotees and we recognize the non-devotees and we know how to interact with them, this will be the cause of our advancement. And what is Uttama? Uttama Adhikari. So this is actually the stage of realization. Yeah? And so Kanishtha and Madhyama are basically sadhana, and Uttama is the stage of realization after sadhana, that is sadhya stage, perfection stage. So he sees Krishna in everything. So in other words, he realizes Sambandha, he realizes the Supreme Lord and how the Lord is in charge of everything. He relishes Krishna in the name and realizes Krishna is not different from his name. He cannot commit nama-aparadhas. And the difference from the Madhyam is he doesn't distinguish Vaishnavas from non-Vaishnavas or anything anymore. No more distinctions anymore. This is some unique quality of the Uttama. Huh? So like the Madhyama, of course, chants, but this is, the taste is more. No nama-aparadha. So the same as the Madhyama also, he has no nama-aparadhas in general. He realizes Sambandha again. The Madhyama doesn't realize, but at least he has the knowledge. And here it becomes realize. As a result of that, he sees Krishna everywhere and everything. So that distinguishes from the Madhyama. Huh? And he doesn't distinguish Vaishnava and non-Vaishnava. Whereas the Madhyama must do so. He avoids asat sangha and associates with devotees. Uttama does not see that difference anymore. Huh? Devotee, non-devotee doesn't matter anymore. Everybody's servant of Krishna. So he may not preach because of this. Everybody's a devotee of Krishna. Everything under the will of Krishna. That's it. So this is taken from 11th canto. This is the definition. The most advanced devotee, Uttamadhikari, sees Lord Krishna, one's object of worship within everything, and sees everything in the Supreme Lord. This sounds like a little bit like Paramatma realization, but we have to distinguish. Or even the Jnani may see everything as one. So for the Prem Bhakta, this means that he actually sees the Lord within everything. Like the gopis and others in Vraja, when they envisage everything is related to the Supreme Lord. So the river appears to be worshipping the Supreme Lord and offering lotuses with its arms, etc. So they see everything in relation to the Supreme Lord. Trees seem to be bowing down to the Lord, etc. Animals seem to be worshipping the Lord. So everything in relation to the Lord. So that is the vision of the Uttamadhikari. So they even see the demons in relation to the Lord as somehow serving the Lord for his pastimes or whatever. Okay, so for remedies, what is a remedy for sadhu-ninda? Of course, we have to repent and understand that it's, we've made some fault and regret that. And the next step is to ask forgiveness from the devotees to whom we've committed offense. So he doesn't give too many details in Harinam Chintamani, but we see in Madhurya Kadambini that Vishnu Chakravarti pays a lot of attention to the details, and there he says that yes, one must repent and one must ask for forgiveness. One cannot say, well, I can avoid asking that person, it doesn't matter because I regret my activities. He says, no, you also have to approach the person and ask for forgiveness. And then, of course, the Vaishnavas are all merciful, so generally the Vaishnav will forgive. But he says, if the Vaishnava does not forgive, what to do? So in that case, all you can do is
resort to chanting the name. That's all you can do at that stage. But in any case, one has to go through that procedure. If one doesn't, what happens is that then the upper rod has effect. And as I said, the unintentional will have less effect and the intentional will have more effect. And Lord Chaitanya calls this offense the mad elephant offense. So it actually destroys bhakti. And it can uproot bhakti completely. Just as the elephant goes into the fields and he tears all everything up. So bhakti's a little creeper and it's growing a little bit. And elephant comes, it can destroy it completely. So it may destroy bhakti completely, then you have no faith even. So once you have no faith, you will not practice bhakti at all. You have no inclination to practice bhakti. So that can be the worst effect. But Vaishnava aparad, it can do that even. So if it's unintentional, even then it may still have some effect. The story is there. I don't know how bona fide it is. I've never seen it in scripture, but anyway. Rupa Goswami, he's the brother of Sanatan Goswami, who is his elder brother, so he takes Sanatan Goswami as his guru. So anyway, Rupa Goswami was doing his bhajan and his bhajan kuti and chanting and, of course, seeing the pastimes of Krishna. So one of the pastime, Krishna began, Rupa Goswami laughed because Krishna was doing something. So he laughed. And he was in his bhajan kuti, some grass house around Radhakund someplace. And at that time, one sadhu happened to pass by who walked a little crooked because he had some problem with his leg. So the sadhu heard Rupa Goswami laugh and he became very disturbed. How can he laugh at me because of my walking? And so he became very irritated by Rupa Goswami and he left. He didn't speak to him, he just left. Rupa Goswami, of course, didn't even see him. Yeah, he was inside his kuti, but he laughed. So the sadhu was thinking Rupa Goswami's such a low person because he's laughing at me. And he went away. And then Rupa Goswami continued his bhajan and chanting and whatever. And then he goes, I cannot concentrate. Something is wrong. I cannot concentrate anymore. So he went to Sanatana Goswami and said, this strange thing is happening. I can't concentrate on Krishna anymore. So then Sanatana Goswami, only one cause is sadhu ninda. You criticize the devotee and that will destroy bhakti. That will cause obstacle. Nothing else can do that. So then Rupa Goswami said, no, I just sit in my bhajan kuti and chant and meditate on the Lord. I don't even see anybody, so how can I commit aparad? And he said, well, that's the only cause. You must have unintentionally offended somebody, and therefore bhakti is decreasing. So Rupa Goswami thought, well, how can I get rid of this aparad? Well, then you have to go to the person, you have to ask apologies from him. So I don't even know who did it. How am I going to do that? So then he thought for a little while and then he got an idea. So he called a festival. Utsava means feed everybody. So he called a festival and he fed all the sadhus in Vrindavan. Yeah, everyone came, everyone had their feast. You know? And then he looked around and he saw who wasn't there. So one person was not there. And then he said, this is the person I must have offended. So then he went to that person and apologized. And then he solved his aparad, so to speak. So the idea is that even, you know, if it's unintentional, it can cause disturbance. So we have to be careful. Of course, this is the more serious it is when it's intentional, then it becomes very serious. But even unintentional aparads can cause problems for the devotees. Okay. Any question there?
Well, of course, that's covered later also. The ninth offense is
preaching to the non-devotees. So how could we preach and not preach without committing the offense? You know, how can we have to avoid preaching if we want to follow that? So the idea is that the first aspect of preaching to people in general is to spread the holy name without giving them the knowledge, so they can hear the name. If they develop interest, then we can preach to them. So that person is at the stage where he's developing some faith, so therefore we can give instructions and we can preach to that person. If he doesn't want to listen, we cannot force him. So in relation to, you know, association, non-association, avoiding the asat sangha, the devotee will have to recognize who is actually inimical to bhakti and the Supreme Lord and the devotees, and avoid that person. The only thing he can do is expose him to the name, and maybe he can hear, and by continuous hearing, then he can lose his inimical nature. Then you can preach to him. So the devotee has to recognize the difference between the, you know, the non-devotee and the devotee and the innocent person. And then accordingly he preaches in different ways to them. Of? Well, if we commit a fault, then first we have to recognize the fault, that we did something wrong. If we don't recognize that, nothing's going to happen. We can apologize, but if we don't think we were faulty, then nothing's going to happen. So first we have to recognize a fault. Now, if it's accidental, of course, it's not a real fault, but we can apologize anyway for that. But if we do have an actual fault, then we have to recognize that we are at fault, and then we have to carry the next stage of going to the person and apologizing for that. So this, and then the person accepts, that generally resolves the problem and doesn't obstruct our bhakti. But if we don't go through those stages, then that seed will continue to fructify and cause obstacles in bhakti.
But the seed doesn't resolve the problem in this life.
It'll continue in next lifetime. It may continue for many lifetimes, effects of aparad. So it will interrupt your bhakti and cause disturbance. So, of course, it's very difficult once this lifetime is gone and next lifetime, how are we going to apologize? We can, basically. All we have to do is tolerate and continue the bhakti in that case. And if we don't know, it's another problem, as in the case of Bharat, he didn't know. But still the effect is going to cause disturbance somewhere along the line. Even in bhava stage, it can cause effect. So that's why, as much as possible, we have to avoid aparads and you know, act very, very discreetly. Okay, I think we'll do one more. I think we can finish this by 12. But anyway, real quick. This is actually the third aparad, but I put a second because it's very similar. Because just as we have sadhu ninda, devotees in general, then we have guru, and to disrespect the guru. So it's an aspect, a sub-aspect, a sub-category of the same offense. So, the devotee is one of the types of devotees, is the guru. So that's a little specialized. So we should define what guru is. So, function of guru? To give mantra, as I said this morning, and spiritual knowledge. Of course, guru here, I mean, is Diksha Guru. So there's a secret mantra that you give. What are the qualifications? Not bodily, again, as previous. Surrender to Krishna. Could be a Brahma Sudra, Vaisha, non-Varnashrama. It could be Grihastha Sannyasi or beyond Vashrama. It doesn't matter. But surrender to Krishna is the main item. And if one is already renounced, then one should take, or is heading towards renunciation, one should take a renunciation guru. So that's the only distinction we make between renounced and not renounced. Yeah? So, we have two types of guru. One is the Diksha Guru. So the Diksha Guru is only one. We can't have many Diksha Gurus, only one Diksha Guru. And he gives us Krishna Mantra and Gauranga Mantra. He should be knowledgeable of the Sampradaya teachings and should have good conduct. That's our standard. Now, this is a verse, a very famous verse which is often quoted, actually two verses. Generally, we only quote the first verse. So we should take it in connection with the second verse also. And it's quoted in Bhakti Sandarbha. And first verse is quoted in Nectar of Instruction. So the first verse actually gives a definition of diksha. Divya Gyanam Yato Dadya Kurya Papasya Sankshayam Tasma Dikshayati Sa Prokta Deshika Tatvako Vidaye. So that is the first verse. And the other one is Ato Gurum Pramanyaiva Sarvasvam Vinivedya Cha Griniya Vaishnava Mantram Diksha Purvam Vidanataha. So the first one gives us the analysis of the word diksha. Like many words in Sanskrit, we get a meaning based upon taking the syllables of the word, like mantra is manas and trayate, to deliver the mind. Or mamsa is me and he. In this lifetime, I kill him. The next lifetime, animal kills me. So we get different analysis based on syllables. So here, the meaning is based on di and cha. So di stands for Divyajnanam, giving spiritual knowledge, Divyajnanam. And Ksha stands for Papasya Samshayam, second line there. Papasya Samshayam, so Ksha, syllable Ksha, destruction. So therefore the Guru gives Sambandhagyan, or transcendental knowledge, and is the destruction of sinful activities, etc. And arkas, all that takes place. So that's the first verse. But the second verse is also there, we cannot forget that. Therefore, one should offer respects to Guru, offer him everything, and accept the Vaishnava mantra according to the rules while taking diksha. So what this means is that giving transcendental knowledge and destroying sin is not the outstanding quality of the diksha guru. Because a shiksha guru can also give transcendental knowledge. So the shiksha guru gives material knowledge, what's the use? Same with also gives spiritual knowledge. So these are Divyajnanam is there, but the distinguishing factor of Diksha Guru is it comes with a mantra. The mantra is conveys this Divyajnanam and the Papasya Sankshaya. So that this is Jiva Goswami's commentary in Bhaktisiddhanta. Divyajnanam is knowledge of the form of the Lord and knowledge of one's particular relationship with the Lord in that sacred mantra. So it's not just Divyajnanam, because Shiksha Guru can also give Divyajnanam. It's not in mantra. And then he says it's mainly for rich householders doing deity worship. Diksha. So, what does Diksha do? Spiritual knowledge is one, that's a positive aspect, and what does it do? It destroys sins, desires, ahankara, all of this, basically. Which also happens in bhakti itself. We have two aspects of bhakti, which are? What does bhakti do? First two qualities of bhakti.
Yes,
Kleshagni and Subhada. Yeah, so same thing. So bhakti in general does this. Mantra will do this with diksha. Holy name does it without diksha. Also, same effect. And so Diksha Guru also gives the same thing. So it's not that only the Diksha Guru gives Divyajnanam. Nobody else does. So diksha means getting mantra in which we get Divyajnanam and destruction of sin. And that Divyajnanam means knowledge of the form of the Lord and relationship with the Lord. So that's in the mantra. What does the mantra do? It defines the form of the Lord. So we get the name of the Lord, Krishna, in the mantra. And our relationship with Krishna, defined by the verbs such as Swaha or Namaha or whatever. We offer respects to the Lord. So we're the servant of the Lord. That is defined in the mantra. What does Nam do? So, we don't need Diksha Guru for Nam. We chant Nam without Guru even. We hear it accidentally, whatever. But, in order to make it effective, we need to get rid of the Abbas. So therefore, we need Sambandhagyan. So we get that from Shiksha Guru. So we have no Diksha, but we get Sudanam through Sambandhagyan from Shiksha Guru. And we get the Divyajnanam, knowledge of the form of the Lord, relationship with the Lord, in Hare Krishna Nam also. And destruction of sin also takes place. So the only difference is mantra. That is the difference between Diksha and Shiksha. But basically the same effect. So, Diksha, we get mantra, the secret mantra that is, and we get sambandha again, and then we do the process that we use that mantra for, archana, deity worship. And nama does not require diksha, does require sambandha again in order to get to sudanama. This is called Bhagavat Marga, and this is the Yuga Dharma. So is it two things there, nama and diksha. Actually, we're chanting before we get that, aren't we? We're already chanting 16 rounds. So it doesn't require diksha. Our ceremony is a little bit confusing because we got three things going on. Getting the name, getting the mantra, getting Brahminical status, which is another thing, a Vedic thing. We have three different types of knowledge going by there. So technically, the name does not need the initiation because we've chanted before then anyway. Huh? But we can say that we should accept at least teachings. So we're accepting Shiksha Guru. So Diksha consists of five elements, Pancharatra Diksha. The most important of which is the mantra. The other aspects are getting name like Krishna Das or Govinda Das or whatever. And getting a tilak. And getting branded, which we don't do. Names, you know, like our Shankar Chakra, getting branded here, but the Sri Vaishnavas still do. Madhavas also do that. And that's another thing called tapa. And then deity worship. So those are the five elements of Pancharatra Diksha. So of those, we get a little bit of that in our first initiation, so to speak. That is, we get the name. But the important aspect, the mantra is only given in the second thing. Yeah? So that's maybe we say where the diksha actually is, in the second, where the person really isn't diksha as such, but we get a little bit of it in the time of getting a name like Govinda Das or Krishna Das. Now added to that, there's a little confusion because we also get the Upanayanam Samskara at the same time. That is based on the fact that if one is qualified as a Vaishnava, he surpasses everything else, so therefore he's qualified to do whatever the Brahman does. And therefore he can also take up the thread and do whatever the Brahman does. So therefore, at the time of getting mantra, then we also get Vedic mantra for Upanayanam, which qualifies us as a twice born, whatever. So we got another initiation, or Vedic initiation going on also, which is secondary again. Was that clear?
Because sometimes we hear that in Vrindavan, when we hear of outside ISKCON, but within the Gaudiya Sampradaya, then the Harinam Diksha was...
They don't do that.
It's just called as Harinam, but it's not called as Diksha.
No, it's not called Diksha. Technically it isn't, because we can only get Diksha once. No? There's only one Diksha. So we can say it's an extended diksha. We get a little bit of it in the first because we get the name, and the second we get the mantra. So it's not two second cannot have two initiations. You can only have one initiation, technically speaking. So they just say giving the name or something like that. But many sampradayas or many groups of Gaudiyas don't have two stages. It's either just chanting, and then it's not really a ceremony at all, and then diksha. That's getting the mantra. No, not only the Gayatri, that's the Vedic part of it. The more important part for us is the Krishna mantras, which includes the Krishna Gayatri and the Gauranga Gayatri and all that. But it's a series of mantras.
So when we understand Prabhupada saying that we are twice born, the second birth after the initiation, so which birth should Prabhupada say?
Well, twice born usually refers to the Upanayanam. But that is secondary, as I said, because Varna is secondary to us anyway. We don't consider that. The main importance is we're getting Vaishnava mantra, which makes us Vaishnava. Secondarily, we can also say we're twice born because of that. Or actually, it's thrice born. Twice born is becoming a Varna person with Upanayanam, and becoming a Vaishnava is the third birth, we can say. Which is more important. So we had the two things here, diksha and anatta. So why do we have the diksha at all? Because of the fickle mind of the devotee, Arshana Marga is often recommended along with Bhagavat Marga to engage all of the senses in deity worship along with the chanting of the name. That's the reason that Jiva Goswami gives in Bhakti Sandarbha for the diksha. Although technically, nama is independent and is not needed. Okay, that was diksha guru. Now we have shiksha gurus. So you could have many shiksha gurus, not just one. And they give in spiritual instructions, sambandhagan and practice of bhakti. And also, devotees who, anyone who's preaching the holy name, he can be considered as a shiksha guru. So, just a comparison. Diksha guru is only one, shiksha guru is many, can be many, can be one also. And it could be the same person, or it could be many persons. It could be diksha guru and shiksha guru could be the same person, or many persons. And the diksha guru also gives knowledge, and the shiksha guru also gives knowledge. The diksha guru gives mantra. The shiksha guru doesn't give that mantra, but he can give the holy name. And of course, the diksha guru can also give the name if he wants. Both like that, so some difference. Oh well, that's not what I meant for.
They do? I don't think they do.
Yeah. Okay, acharyas. So the founding acharyas and great acharyas are called the principal shiksha gurus, and they should be given respect also. So they're also shiksha guru, even though they may not be present. Everyone in the sampradaya should follow the founder's instructions and teachings and not accept teachings outside the sampradaya. Okay. Yeah. Well, we get into a little confusion there because we have four bona fide sampradayas, but nevertheless, we do have different objects of worship. So Sri Sampradaya and Madhava Sampradaya will accept Vishnu as supreme and we accept Krishna as supreme. So our Siddhanta is a little different in the details. So we both accept bhakti. Nevertheless, our Sampradaya goes towards worshiping Radha and Krishna. So if we start accepting other principles and start worshiping Vishnu instead, then we should belong to a different Sampradaya. So we can't confuse the issues. We can study the philosophy and compare it, but we should not take up that philosophy, otherwise it becomes confusing. And we may end up worshipping a different form of God or whatever, or a different mood or whatever. So, in either case, one should respect. The topic here is guru or avagya, disrespecting guru. So we have two types of guru, and we have to respect both, the shiksha guru and the diksha guru. And in fact, it says in the scripture that equal respect is given to both. Because they are dear servants to Krishna, and we should serve them with great devotion. And the procedure is we worship guru, then we take permission, and then we worship the deity. So when we're in deity worship, we should worship guru first, and then worship deity. So, how does one serve the guru? We respect his asana, his bed, his shoes, his vehicle, his water, and his shadow even. So you shouldn't step on a shadow, technically. And follow his instructions, which is very important. Offer pranamas, respect his name, try to please him. And, of course, the ultimate instruction is to chant the holy name. So the service to guru is, some of it is physical, and some of it is following his order in terms of practicing bhakti. Okay, so then there may be a problem of rejection of guru. So the guru himself may lose his qualification by asat sangha, commit nama parad, and lose his spiritual knowledge. And he may become hostile to Vaishnavas, lose taste for the name, and develop desire for wealth and women. So in that case, one can reject. And then one should accept a qualified guru. If one does not reject that previous guru and he's in a very, very fallen state, one will also have the danger of damaging his own devotional service because he maintains that contact and relationship with that person who's fallen. So it's like asat sangha. So in order to prevent this whole situation, the scriptures always tell us that one should very carefully choose guru. We have to examine very carefully and choose guru, not just take because somebody else says or whatever. We have to develop it on faith and based on observation and study of shastras to see qualification of guru. So it's not a whimsical choice. So this will help prevent this type of problem. Okay, so the disrespect to guru, this of course means a qualified guru, not the unqualified one who falls. So disrespect, if we reject a guru who is qualified, then that becomes the offense. And so become an obstacle to devotion, and then we can't advance in devotional service. And what is the cause? Bad association, again, asasanga, and reading false literature. We read, asat literature, which talks about either impersonalism or atheism or devata worship, etc. This can be a cause also. Or, of course, material literature of any sort. And what is the remedy? We have to ask forgiveness from Guru. Okay, I think we finished it. Okay, that's it. We've got our 2 hours up. Yeah. Yeah, he got in trouble too. But then finally his guru forgave him. Because Ramanuja said, I felt so compassionate to all living entities that I had to give this mantra out. Guru was angry in the beginning. But then as Ramanuja persuaded him finally, that because of my compassion, I could not help do that. So he forgave him. But definitely it was a problem. Okay, any question?
I guess one gets qualified for taking the diksha, the mantra of the first association has to become twice more.
Well, the whole guru, we're not trying to be twice born. We're trying to be Vaishnavas. The twice born aspect is secondary because it's Varna. Yeah? And Varna, as I said, is not the qualification. We're not seen in terms of Varna. That was introduced by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, actually, to just combat those people who said that Vaishnavas are less than Brahmanas. And therefore they're not qualified to do deity worship. So he says, no, Vaishnavas are more qualified than Brahmanas. They can do anything that Brahmana does, plus more. So therefore, when he gave a diksha, he also gave the Upanayanam, only for that purpose. So that's secondary consideration.
So the time of Upanayanam, we should receive the mantra also from the
What's that?
At the time of Upanayanam, we get the mantra also from
the You get the Vedic mantra. So that's a Vedic initiation for Upanayanam. And then we get Pancharatrik mantra for Vaishnava initiation. So that Vedic mantra is general for all twice born people, Vaishnava or non-Vaishnavas. They all take that mantra. Same mantra. That's entrance to the Vedas, studying the Vedas. But the Pancharatra mantra gives us qualification for deity worship. In the Krishna Bhajanamrita, there Narahari Sakar, I think, says that they should be generally equal, but one should take permission from the Diksha Guru to take teachings from the Siksha Guru, so that there's no contradiction in the teachings. So he's a little bit of a superiority in one sense, but you should give him equal respect. This, of course, refers to the Shiksha Guru that you're taking serious teachings from. But there's another concept of Shiksha Guru where everybody who's preaching is a Shiksha Guru. It doesn't mean that. This means where you actually accept a person and take serious teachings from him. Then you become a Shiksha Guru in that sense. Then one should offer equal respect to that person as a Diksha Guru. How do we emphasize Diksha Guru? I think in ISKCON, basically, when you talk about Guru, we only consider Diksha Guru. And we don't think much about Shiksha Guru at all. Because Guru means the one you get Diksha from. But technically we see there's two types there, and both are important. But in one sense, the Shiksha Guru is more important because we don't have the teachings. We still have Nama Bas.
Just a quick comment, and also on the same point, because when we say Vani and Bapu, so it's not always possible to be in physically close association with the spiritual master, so it's only Vani of the spiritual master and also Vani of the visiting gurus.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important. We need to go for Sikshadu as well for taking more shelter within myself.
So what's the question?
It's a comment actually.
Oh.
Basically, one and Bhakti, so one is more important than Bhakti.
Well, both are there, but ultimately, if we don't follow the Vani, we can't practice bhakti. We're not practicing bhakti, so obviously that is the essential one. And if we can, then we do the Vapusev also, if possible. But if we don't follow the Vani, then we're hopeless. Yeah. Oh, different instructions. Well, we're talking here about mainly philosophical instructions, or instructions on bhakti, rather than, you know, more localized instructions on, you know, what service you're doing in the temple or something like that. And then the other point, of course, is that, that even the instructions should be unified. So that is why Narahari says that one should go to the Diksha Guru and, you know, get permission from him, and then repeat everything back to the Diksha Guru so that the teachings are in line. They're not different teachings. As far as detailed instructions, yes, they may differ. So therefore, we have to be a little careful there and, you know, distinguish.
Yes, well, it's consistent because we follow the family of Chakra, and everybody's instructions should be
in line
with the family of Chakra rather than, say, with the Diksha Guru in that example from the Vajramita.
Yes. Well, of course, the Diksha Guru's teachings have to fall in line with the Sampradaya teachings. Yeah, definitely. So the all actually goes back. So we have Lord Chaitanya, then we have Acharyas. And from that we get our Sampradaya teachings, and then it comes down to the Prabhupada, and then gurus of the present time. So that should all be in line. There shouldn't be contradiction there.
So it is interesting you emphasized, or certainly it came strongly to me, that the Diksha Guru and the Siksha Guru are actually equal in that they do transcendental knowledge and lead one to the enlightenment. The difference is that one gives the mantra
and
initiation. So, my question was, why do we
I don't know.
We say, oh no, this one's better.
I don't know.
But the power of both.
And name is independent of Diksha, so we go on chanting anyway. It's our culture, I guess.
So
that's all.
Have this culture that, oh, I am a religion. I've got my mantra, so definitely he's better than anybody else.
So we think of guru, we think of Diksha Guru. But
yeah, actually, he may not be.
Yeah.
Actually, he may not be.
Yeah.
But somebody else
could
might be able to give us the
teachings more.
Teachings more powerfully and more effective.
True.
And, you know, the other thing that I think about often is the guru often doesn't even know the disciple very well.
Yeah,
the people who are working with him,
course,
know him best.
Yeah.
And so, in one sense, more qualified to give instruction.
True. Sure.
But no, the disciple won't listen to the people who know best. Select, you know, they'll take the instruction that they like to receive, and like, this is the one I'll follow. And tend to ignore the Siksha Guru who probably knows them even better.
Well, that's our, let's say, our maybe misunderstanding. Guru means Diksha Guru. Some sort of culture we establish.
I think it's also come about from the fact that Prabhupada was such a prominent personality as the founder of Acharya and the original initiating guru that somehow or other there's this
two things get merged.
Somehow because you've now become, or because somebody's become a Diksha Guru, that means that somehow
got that authority, same authority. True.
And it's sort of like this concept of what a guru actually is, somehow this very larger than life personality that has all this sort of shakti.
Yeah, so the whole thing is, I think, because of the emphasis on the Diksha. But as we see, actually, the Diksha is there, but it's to give mantra. But then somehow we get that complicated and we think he's the one who gives me the knowledge, he gives everything and nobody else does.
So we exclude everybody else.
And but Prabhupada says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that the person who gives you diksha is usually the person who's been giving you instruction.
True.
So the sitcha has already come.
Yeah.
And he's destroyed that ignorance. Establishes the sambandhagyan.
Yeah, already.
Then to give the mantra, the initiation takes place.
Yeah.
The sitcha has already been established.
True. Yeah.
But we have a different. We have other people give you sitcha. Then somebody else comes along, gives you the mantra, then all of a sudden they're the most important person.
Yeah.
Whereas actually it was all these other people who brought you to consciousness, who trained you as a devotee. They're actually the ones who've already done all of the building work to bring you to the point of diksha.
Change the system.
Understand the system.
It's
the most important thing.
Yeah.
If possible, but if not, then they'll have to just decide later themselves.
Okay. Yeah.